The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we do ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material or the materials nor induce any specific products. On slide number 5, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers today. All of them have been active members of ITRC's long-term contaminant management using institutional controls team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they have dedicated many hours to develop this guidance document. A special thank you to all of them for participating today. If you would like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios in the related link section on CLUIN by clicking the presenters tab on the training page. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Kevin to get us started today.
Okay, thank you, Devin, and thank you to all the attendees who are participating today. We're excited for the opportunity to introduce to you or reintroduce to you the guidance document that is available that's been with ITRC for over 5 years. Before the other trainers dive into the specifics of our materials, I want to take some time for institutional controls and set the stage, lay the groundwork on how our guidance was developed and how it might be beneficial to you. So for many of you on the call, the concept of leaving contamination in place was previously not an acceptable way of achieving closure under most regulatory programs. Most programs required contamination to be cleaned up to background or native concentrations. Now, since the mid-1990s, risk-based corrective action, some people refer to it as RBECCA, and the use of ICs have become an important part of many federal, state, and local cleanup and brownfield programs. ICs are generally administrative or legal controls that help to minimize the potential for exposure now and into the future to contamination and protect the integrity of the remedy. ICs have helped fuel redevelopment and reduce the cost and time to achieve closure at many sites. As an aside, where I'm from, the state of Michigan, has had the tagline of R4R, or remediation for redevelopment, emphasizing considering sites for remediation work based on the potential for redevelopment of the site and the environment and public health risks. Now, for more background discussion of institutional controls, you can read the ITRC 2008 document that is noted on the screen. The terminology and process descriptions used in this guidance are consistent with those used in the federal Superfund program. In addition to the bullets, the picture on the right half of the screen also visually illustrates the differences between engineering controls, which are vapor barriers, physical or hydraulic containment, asphalt or concrete, or vapor mitigation systems. Now, institutional controls are those paper descriptions of legal restrictions. These can include deed restrictions, ordinances, or other state or local regulations. Protect the integrity of the engineering control or minimizes the potential for human exposure to contamination. Now, both of these terms are incorporated under the umbrella of land use controls. These are used to provide protection from exposure to contaminants that exist or remain on a site. Upon initiating the process of developing this guidance, ITRC understood that state agencies use ICs at contaminated sites as remedies. That's pretty common. However, we did not know the full extent of their use. ITRC also did not understand the various state agency IC selection and implementation processes or the regulatory framework governing the IACs in a particular state. Finally, ITRC wanted to gather and determine how states manage and fund those institutional controls once they are in place, along with any data indicating that state agencies performed monitoring, tracking, enforcement, and stakeholder outreach. To better understand these questions, ITRC surveyed existing state programs to determine what makes these programs effective and what issues affect the long-term durability of institutional controls. The survey was submitted to ITRC representatives for all 50 states, and 44 responses were received. Overall, the survey responses have been used to identify which elements help maintain or create a more effective long-term institutional control program. As shown on the screen, this guidance focuses on IACs already in place rather than the details of selecting institutional controls. Properly selecting and implementing IACs, however, is essential for long-term durability and effectiveness. Therefore, this guidance provides a summary of some of the key components that are considered when choosing an IAC. Now, during the presentation and in our guidance document, you will see this diagram, which illustrates the five essential elements of the IAC lifecycle. Beneath the elements of the lifecycle, we list the critical components that must be considered to achieve a successful IAC management program. These essential elements and components essentially form the structure of the guidance document, and various sections in the guidance document address each of these elements. Together, these create an effective long-term stewardship program. As the presenters transition between each element, you will see this figure reappear on the screen, highlighting the next topic. This guidance is relevant to environmental regulators at all levels of government, private and public responsible or obligated parties, current site owners and operators, environmental consultants, prospective purchasers of property, and those in the real estate world. Additionally, stakeholders who have an interest in property will find this guidance helpful in understanding the elements required to manage institutional controls. This guidance also assists those who are responsible for the stewardship of IACs by describing critical elements and best practices for an IAC management program. Much of this document is based on the successes and lessons learned from established state and federal agency programs. As a part of the guidance, ITRC has also developed a downloadable tool that can help to create a long-term stewardship plan tailored to specific sites. This tool incorporates the various IAC management practices presented here to assist in the early stages of site-specific IAC planning. Stay tuned. So I'd like to offer an example from my state to describe an example of a failure of institutional control, because they have and unfortunately may continue to exist, especially with the increase in reliance on institutional controls. A prospective purchaser of property was conducting due diligence prior to purchasing that property. The property was the location of a former leaking underground storage tank that was closed in 1997 with an institutional control in the form of a deed restriction, which included a groundwater use restriction and a requirement that the property retain its commercial zoning. During the due diligence efforts, the prospective purchaser found that the property had been split into two parcels since the original deed restriction, one now parcel being zoned as residential with a home built and a new drinking water well established in 2001. These circumstances went undetected by the regulatory agency until 2015, when a prospective purchaser called the regulatory agency asking about the closure and the land use restrictions concerning the well. Now, subsequent investigatory work was conducted and fortunately determined that the new resident and drinking water well were side gradient of the contaminated groundwater plume, and the violations of the land use restriction did not result in a long-term exposure to groundwater contamination. The breach of the institutional control had occurred a mere 4 years after placement of the restrictions on groundwater and land use. This should be well within the institutional knowledge that can be reasonably expected of an agency staff with land use and permitting agencies operating as separate entities from the regulatory environmental agency. The lack of an outreach program and monitoring program led to confusion and ultimately the permitting of a drinking water well, a zoning change, split parcels with different addresses and parcel ID numbers from the original parcel that contained the restrictions. Presumably, an outreach program aimed at local health departments, which is the water well permitting agency, they would have likely known of the contaminated groundwater in the area and would have been better informed about the groundwater use restrictions. In recent years, the regulatory agency has implemented an outreach program with the health departments to discuss the use of an online environmental mapper and database to ensure that they have all the information to fully evaluate drinking water well applications and assist them in making good and protective permitting decisions. So, we heard about one example of why ICs fail. Let's see some other examples. And Devin brought up a poll. So if we can vote on that, then we can dive in a little bit deeper into what you've experienced. Okay, if we can see those results. Okay, so somewhat similar to previous ITRC presentations of the front runners for the voting, typically involves either communication is not adequate or the monitoring of the institutional control is inadequate. And in this case, communication was again the lead issue for folks. And then some of the other issues, monitoring, reporting, those were kind of side by side with some of the institutional control failures. So as our guidance document lays out, there can be a physical break of a barrier, inadequate reporting, inadequate monitoring, violations of the restrictions, and finally, inadequate communications. Sometimes the location of the contamination isn't described sufficiently, or databases or other mechanisms that could be used as tools may not be available. Now, what makes institutional control failures a significant issue, as I was previously alluding to, is that the potential for exposure grows as more ICs are used and not properly managed and monitored. To illustrate the universe of ICs used across the nation, this map indicates that 60% of states that responded to our survey stated that they have over 200 institutional controls in place in their states. But what we have seen is that the programs to manage the ICs vary widely, and some states did not have any formal institutional control management program. There are solutions to prevent failures of institutional controls, which is presented in ITRC's new guidance document and discussed in today's presentation. An IC can only remain effective so long as it's continued to be recognized, respected, and upheld by the affected stakeholders. Not only does the awareness of a new institutional control need to be communicated to the affected community, but this awareness should be maintained throughout the life of the IC. Stakeholder outreach, discussed later in the presentation, includes identifying and involving internal and external stakeholders throughout the IC lifecycle. So again, it focuses on that communication aspect that is a potential lead for failure. In addition to the guidance document, as I said before, ITRC went one step farther and developed a downloadable tool that takes users through the process of planning and designing IC management needs. This tool can help create a long-lasting record of the site that includes regulatory authority, details of the IC, the responsibilities of all parties, a schedule for monitoring the performance of ICs, and more. The tool generates an editable long-term stewardship plan in Microsoft Word. If you are a consultant, a regulated entity who is performing a state-funded closure on sites with long-term monitoring, or any other type of individual in the regulated community, you really want to stay tuned to near the end of today's session, where we will provide a brief tutorial on this tool. Up next is Doug Birch, representative from Ramble, who will be briefly discussing planning and implementation and then stakeholder outreach.
Thanks, Kevin. So here's our lifecycle diagram. You'll see a lot of it in the upcoming presentation. Kevin's already introduced it. As you can see, the first two elements on that are planning and implementation. Now, so our guidance assumes that the planning and implementation part of this has already been done. We've moved on to the next stage, which is the long-term management and maintenance of the institutional controls. You know, we as a group realize there's no need to reinvent the wheel. Well, there's already, as Kevin mentioned, there's some ITRC guidance on implementing institutional controls. There's state guidance, federal guidance, which is all great. And I've used it quite a bit. I closed a site in Nebraska using Nebraska's guidance. I'm literally writing a completion report right now that includes institutional controls in Illinois, and their guidance is great. But where it tends to come up a little short is the long-term management of those institutional controls. It's great for the sprint of getting the institutional controls implemented, but then you have the marathon afterwards of maintaining those institutional controls over the long term. But since these are portions of the beginning of an institutional control, I want to provide a brief summary on the planning and implementation. Oops, sorry. Okay, the first element is planning. So that means know your site, assess the characteristics, know what's going on. I mean, that kind of goes without saying. I think most of us on this call know that if you're going to work on a site, you have to know what the issues are and what the issues aren't. And if you don't know that, you're not going to be able to design an institutional control that serves the purpose of protecting public health. So also another thing in part of this planning is plan for the costs of a institutional control. There's the short-term costs of actually creating the institutional control, putting in reports and whatnot. But also there's a long-term management cost associated with institutional controls. They're not a get out of jail free card. You have to be prepared to maintain things over the long term once you start with those. So implementation, that's formalizing your IC. Now, once you've completed the planning phase, you've moved on to implementation, but it's more than just a piece of paper sitting in your local recorder's office. It's just the beginning of your journey. Like I said, you're starting your marathon now. So almost half of the respondents to our survey, ITRC survey, indicated the lack of proper implementation was a reason for IC failure. So long-term stewardship is a critical element in successfully implementing the institutional control. That's part of the continuing implementation. And as Kevin mentioned, later in this, we'll have a discussion of a tool we put together. Lynn Bailey is going to be providing the summary on that, that talks to the long-term stewardship plan, which is a very helpful something to consider for maintaining that implementation over the long term. So moving on to the critical components for communication and outreach. The critical components of these are to identify your stakeholders, establish and maintain communication with those stakeholders, and also you need to inform the stakeholders of their roles and responsibilities with the institutional control. You know, these are all like ingredients. If you have them all in the proper amount, you're going to have a good institutional control. But if you miss out, you don't inform stakeholders, or you limit how much you inform stakeholders, you're not going to have a successful outreach. So our survey determined that about 40%, nearly half of IC failures, were a direct result of inadequate communication. And our poll result kind of reinforces that as well. So think about that. That's almost half of your ICs could have been successful if they would have communicated them properly. So remember, outreach success is institutional control success. If you're going to fail in outreach, you're going to have institutional control failure. So who or what are stakeholders? Now, stakeholders are affected and or interested parties. They include a lot of groups. I mean, here's just a short list of them here. We have a table in our guidance document that provides a summary of these stakeholders and their roles and responsibilities that they may or may not play. I mean, it's future property owners, obviously the actual property owner, but there's a long list, consultants, construction workers. It's a very long list. So be aware that there's a long list of affected stakeholders and make sure you include them and know what their roles and responsibilities are. Because if you leave them out, the chances are that's the person who's going to go out there and put in a well when they're not supposed to. So where do these stakeholders fit in? Well, they all have concerns and they all have some responsibilities at some level. Common concerns are, you know, health. How is this going to affect my health or the health of people living on here? A big one is obviously value of the property. Can I develop my property or how can I not develop my property? So you have to know what's going on with the institution controls and what that's a concern that you have to make sure you're addressing it so it's going to be successful. So responsibilities include record keeping. I have a site in Minnesota we closed out. We have the property owner, the current property owner, which is our client, has to send in self-report and do a letter to the state agency to confirm that that's still maintained and hasn't been a problem of the institutional control. So that's a responsibility they have to take on every year. It's a pretty good thing to keep them aware of things. And also, if institutional control says not to do something, you don't do it. You don't put in a well on a property that says no groundwater use. And you have to make sure that, see, you know, there's a communication breakdown. That institutional control wasn't known and that went ahead and went in, as Kevin talked to. So stakeholders are a wide range of individuals and groups, and so are their concerns, you know, and their responsibilities, and as well as their information needs. So be aware of that. So moving on to communication methods, there's several of them available. The primary ones are push and pull, or direct and passive outreach. So direct outreach, which is also known as push, means you're actually literally pushing the information out to your stakeholders. This can include something as simple as, like I show here, a don't eat the fish sign or a no fishing sign, something very simple like that, that just kind of makes people aware. Can also be something much more sophisticated, like a utility marking request that actually locates and tells you about institutional controls on a site. You know, that's a very powerful tool. It's not available everywhere. My colleague Mike Sawinski is going to speak to this a little bit later in the presentation, but it's something to know about. If you have that available, make use of those sorts of things to push information out to your stakeholders. So passive outreach is also known as pull. That means when the stakeholders are actually reaching out and pulling in the information. That starts with putting information on a property deed. If they've researched the property deed, they'll see that information on there. And putting information in searchable databases. Here's actually a screenshot from the state of Missouri near my neighborhood and in the city of St. Louis. And as a community member of the community, I could consider myself a potential stakeholder. So I can look in and zoom in and find different locations where there's institutional controls and pull information out and find out what's going on. So I mentioned that site in Omaha. When we closed it, our client sold the property and it was later subdivided. and we pushed information. We gave information to the new property owners on what those institutional controls were. Well, fast forward a few years, and one of those property owners was looking to do some additional construction on their property. They reached out to me. There's going to be some excavation. Is there going to be an issue with this? And so we talked it through, and they had a pretty good handle on it. They had already been provided the proper information, but they were verifying that they were interpreting it correctly. So after that call, there's a perfect example of push and pull working together in tandem. We gave the information to the new property owner, and they've reached out to find that information. And so our institutional control maintained itself and was successful. So ignorance isn't bliss when it comes to institutional control. So our ITRC survey, stakeholder outreach, it needs improvement. Based on our survey, the vast majority of outreach is specifically directed toward current landowners. Now, obviously, they are a very important part of the process, but you have new landowners and you're not even getting half of them involved in the process. And then you get into the tenants and adjacent property owners, and it starts to drop off very quickly. Obviously, there's a lot more stakeholders in this, and that 20% number is going to start going down to zero to single digits and below. And again, if you're not communicating these to stakeholders or potential stakeholders, you're going to have issues with your institutional control surviving over the long term. So use robust institutional control and outreach to educate your stakeholders. Identify and provide outreach to all your potential stakeholders. Be aware of and anticipate their information needs. Tailor that information to the stakeholders, and also make it, put it in layman's terms. I mean, we tend to use a lot of big language and acronyms and whatnot, but that's just going to fall flat on its face if someone's sitting on a backhoe trying to interpret some very specific document that's very technically written. Make sure it's something that's understandable. Use both push and pull communication methods, as we described. And remember, ICs and communication of those ICs aren't static. Revisit your outreach over time. There's always new potential ways to outreach. There could be a new state push on that, new registries, new ways to develop that. So keep that in the back of your mind. So don't just set it and forget it. You got to be aware that this is an ongoing thing. And again, that IC stewardship tool, I think, is something that we're going to introduce as something that would be helpful in the long term. So something to think about. So we've discussed the big need for available and easily understood and up-to-date information on records and for stakeholder communication and outreach. And Carol Murphy of Tri-Hydro is going to discuss data management and registries.
Okay, thank you, Doug. Today I'm going to be talking about registries and data management. I do not have the availability to forward slides. So,
Carol, I gave you control if you want to just click your screen.
Got it.
Perfect.
How do I go back now? Shoot. Sorry.
The back arrow?
Yeah, it's just not showing up on my screen. Okay. If you can go back one, that'd be great. I may have to have you do it. As Doug said, I'm going to be talking about registries and data management. While we were developing the guidance document, our team determined that an effective long-term institutional control management program really depended on timely discovery and accurate input of data associated with the institutional controls. So we determined that a key attribute to a successful IC management program would include methods to manage the data so that it's readily available to the various stakeholders that Doug talked about previously. And to tie this into what Doug talked about on communication methods, registries can be used as a tool to communicate institutional controls to the various stakeholders and would qualify as a pull method of communication. So what are we talking about when we talk about registries, and why do we think a registry is important? Well, institutional controls are commonly recorded on property deeds or covenants that are often recorded at a local land records office or a local agency office. And this system presents limitations that can result in lack of awareness of the institutional control. So, for example, the terms of the institutional control, the details of the institutional control, and the requirements of it may only be reviewed occasionally during property transactions. And if the property has not had experienced a transaction in a while, the owner or operators of the facility may actually have forgotten about the institutional controls. Or the restrictions may have never been disclosed in the first place to, say, an operator or a tenant at the property. You know, the owner might know about the institutional control, but an operator or a tenant may not have been notified. And then also regulators, when an institutional control is filed away at a deed office, a regulator may not be able to easily recognize non-compliance with the institutional control if they're not aware of it either, if they haven't actually read it. So a data management system and a registry can help resolve some of these limitations of having a hard copy of a deed restriction filed away at an agent, at, you know, at a local agency's office. So a registry is essentially an electronic database that identifies the location and the requirements of the institutional control. And they can be maintained by various entities. A registry could be maintained by state and federal agencies or local government agencies, such as a county health department. But it could also be maintained by corporate environmental managers who are managing multiple properties or a portfolio of properties. Okay, so now we have a poll question. And the question is, have any of you experienced or witnessed a problem or violation of an institutional control due to the lack of awareness where a registry could have made a difference? And, you know, one example of this might that we've already talked about today was the case study that Kevin presented earlier on the property in Michigan that was subdivided and subsequently sold. And it had an IC in place to prohibit the use of the property for residential use. Yet after it was subdivided, the property was redeveloped. Part of it was redeveloped for residential use. So inadequate communication and monitoring in this case were the primary causes of failure of the institutional control. And if the property developers had been aware of the IC, the situation would likely have been prevented. So we'll wait a couple of minutes here to see if, or a few seconds anyway, to see if we have results. Okay, it looks like in this case, about most of you said no, but about 30% said yes, you've actually witnessed this, and about 35% are not certain. So definitely this is a real situation that has happened in many people's experience. So in the state survey that we performed back in 2015, when we were developing the guidance document, we asked the states if they employed an institutional control data management system, such as a searchable database or a registry. And at that time, only a handful of states said that they did not have a data management system. And most of the states at that time had some form of a registry system or data management system. And at the time of the survey, over half of the states that did have systems did allow public access to the database, while the other states had systems that were only for use by the regulatory agency. So in the first poll question that we asked today, I noticed that 62% of you had indicated that inadequate communication is a common reason for failure of an institutional control. And similarly, when we asked the states in our survey about common causes of failure of ICs, over 30% of the respondents indicated that inadequate communication was a common cause for failure. So when asked how they would improve their state's IC program at the time, back in 2015, several of the respondents indicated that better tracking systems and registries would be important. And when they were asked about the causes of IC failures in their states, the responses indicated that a good registry could have prevented some of the failures. So based on the survey, when we were developing the guidance document, we determined that the development and use of a registry by the agency could help prevent IC failures. So registries can be used by agencies to help keep track of ICs. So for example, the registry could be used to schedule obligations under the IC, for example, like land use obligations. It could also be used to document points of contact for long-term stewardship, roles and responsibilities. And the registry could also document breaches of the institutional control or non-compliance with the institutional control. Whoops, shoot. Can you go back one? For some reason, the arrows are not showing up for me. Thank you. All right, the guidance document also provides several examples of existing state registry systems, just to give you some ideas of what some of the state registry systems look like. And this slide showed an example of the Missouri Institutional Control Registry maintained by the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. The example that you see on the screen, we thought this was a good example of what a good registry might look like, which is why we used it. But what it, the example you see shows that agencies data input, and this is the summary page that you would see when you go there. And there are tabs across the top that detail where the details can be entered into each tab. Information entered into the system on this site includes items such as basic site information, like the name and address of the facility, agency and site contacts and their obligations and roles and responsibilities. Shows the contaminants, of course, and the media impacted, whether it's soil or groundwater. It includes the objectives of the IC and the type and details of the instrument. So is it a restrictive covenant? Maybe it requires no disturbance of the soil or no use of the groundwater, or maybe it prohibits land use to non-residential use. So those details can be included on the Missouri Registry. It also includes ongoing activities and monitoring, and it also, reports can also be entered into the system. So now we're going to switch gears to talk a little bit about the public and what their use of an IC registry might look like. And basically the public can use the registry as a resource to search for and learn about ICs in their area or in the area that they're working in. So the public may include various entities. It might include property owners. It might include buyers or developers of the property. It might include adjacent landowners or users of the property. It could also include utility or construction workers on the property. And then, of course, it could include people that are performing environmental due diligence, such as attorneys or consultants on behalf of clients. The public can use the registry for a variety of reasons. For example, owners might use the registry to help them develop long-term stewardship plans to ensure success and compliance with the institutional control. Of course, construction and utility workers might use the registry prior to excavation to prevent a violation of an institutional control, such as a breach of a cap if they're going to be breaking the surface of the ground. And then workers, buyers, and due diligence professionals might use the registry to understand the restrictions that have been implemented on the site to help them manage their risks associated with use of the site. And all of these uses should help prevent, theoretically, should help prevent violation of the institutional control. And ultimately, it should help prevent exposure to contamination that has been left in place at the site. This next slide shows the public page of the same MDNR registry system that we showed earlier when we were discussing the agency use of the registry. This page offers the public a quick description of the status of the long-term stewardship at a site, which also includes the institutional control. And the public user on this site can search for a cleanup site by county, by city, by zip code, or a specific address. And then as you can see on the screen, there's color coding, which differentiates the cleanup sites into four categories. First, you have active sites, which are red. Those are sites that are undergoing investigation or remediation. Then you have sites that are categorized as long-term stewardship sites. Those are sites that might have activity and use limitations. For example, it must be limited to non-residential use. The purple is sites referred to as environmental notice sites, which are sites where an environmental advisory might be warranted. And then the green would be sites where cleanup has been completed and they are suitable for unrestricted use. So cleanup is finished at those locations. So in a quick snapshot on this registry, you can see that all the sites in the system with their color-coded status. When developing an IC registry, we determined as we were developing the guidance document that there are several components to include that in the registry that we think are critical to the success of the registry. First of all, the registry should include a complete inventory of all of the ICs that are located within the jurisdictional boundary of the agency that's developing the registry. Next, the registry should include all the key attributes of the registry, of the institutional control, similar to the one we saw on the MDNR site, such as the location of the site, land use restrictions, and obligations of the owner. Next, the registry should be available to both internal and external users, third parties, and the public. As we discussed on the survey, when we did the survey, some of the agency registries were only available internally. So we believe it's important for them to be available both internally and externally. And the agency finally should review the registry frequently to confirm the completeness and accuracy of its contents. And one other thing to note is that institutional controls may be recorded by an entity other than the state agency. So development and maintenance of the registry can get a bit complicated in these situations. Now, we also determined when we were developing the guidance document that routine maintenance of the registry is very important to ensure its success. And the agency should have a process to regularly add, delete, modify, and correct errors in the institutional controls in the registry. I know in my work, I've looked at state registries and then talked to facilities who indicate that the information in the registry was incorrect. So it could be a typographical error in data entry, or something may have changed to where the information on the registry is no longer true. So it's important to to regularly check for errors, and corrections should be performed routinely. The agency should also have a process for routine backups and archiving of the registry, and have version control features that should be verified regularly. And then finally, the agency should, of course, plan and budget for periodic IT upgrades of the registry. Now, here's one more example of the public use page from the MDNR system. And you can see here that the map shows activity and use limitation areas as a polygon. So remember, we said that the registry should include the location of the institutional control. Well, it's ideally you would be able to show the boundaries of the institutional control as well as in this site. The cleanup site icon is clickable on this site, and then it reveals information in a balloon identifying the AUL with a link to a detailed summary of the AUL. And in this example, you can see that this site is in long-term stewardship and must perform inspections and maintenance of engineered controls. And you can click on the link for more information. So that wraps up our discussion on registries and data management, and Michael Sawinski will present our next section on monitoring and performance evaluation.
All right, thank you, Carol. So with that, we are going to start off our first Q&A portion of the training today. If you have any questions that you want the trainers to address, please put them in the Q&A pod and we'll get to those. Just a quick reminder again that we do have feedback forms available at the end of the training to support your documentation of continuing education. So with that, we will pause here and see if any questions come up. And if we don't have any, we do have a second Q&A portion at the end of the training. So you have two opportunities to ask questions. But if not, we can go on to the next module and go through the training, but we'll pause for some questions here. All right. So we have a question, which is two parts. Do archaeological agencies typically interact with public health agencies or EPA with or without a registry? What are ways to create outreach streams from an established IC to perhaps emerging archaeological protections due to recent or possible legislation passings?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we're kind of a little more focused on the environmental end. Archaeological is obviously another resource that needs to be protected. And I think that is certainly something that could use some institutional control knowledge. That wasn't anything that, you know, I've dealt with directly as far as an archaeological. That's usually required as part of site development and whatnot. So I think that oftentimes gets captured there.
All right. Thank you, Doug. Next question. How do registries accommodate updates to the contamination? For example, a developer excavates all of the contamination as part of digging the underground parking garage.
Yeah, so I guess, you know, then you update your, you know, again, it's a living, breathing document. You update as necessary to provide less stringent or more stringent institutional controls on the property. So then you have to adjust the institutional control to fit the current situation. You know, you don't want to necessarily have an institutional control that's overbearing or unnecessary. So then you have to go back and just, I guess, fix the institutional control or make it more current to the current situation.
I'll add to Thomas's question. I mean, in the majority of cases, the institutional control at issue is recorded in some sort of covenant. And when the site conditions are fixed, basically, like you were saying, the legal process involved is to modify the existing covenant or to terminate the existing covenant and refile that new document. So you file like an actual new piece of paper that's called modification of covenant one, modification of covenant two, which in turn ripples through to update the state's registry. That's the normal process anyway. But if you are, in my experience, if you are the person who has fixed the problem, it's kind of on you often to make sure that all the rest of the process ripples through correctly, because life's just not perfect.
All right, thank you, Michael and Doug. Next question. In my state, it is easy to set up an institutional control for a commercial site. However, it is a more delicate process in a residential site. Owners typically do not want them because it would be an environmental covenant on the property and would have to keep it upon resale of the property. Can you go over some key differences with institutional controls in regards to property types?
I can address that unless someone else wants to go first. In my experience, many years ago now, working with EPA on this, yeah, there definitely are some differences based on property type. When a current residential owner refuses to record a covenant, even though the environmental agency wishes that they would, one option that I've seen work is for environmental agencies or someone to record a notice in the deed. There's in many states, the legal authority exists to put a notice on the deed, which isn't actually a legal restriction, just a piece of information, which can act at the very least to inform people in the future that that issue exists, even though it doesn't provide an actual legal restriction on the covenant. So that's one thing. The other thing that agencies do is they look to government controls like groundwater ordinances. If groundwater is the issue that can impact the site at issue, that aren't dependent on the property owner agreeing to them. So government controls or recorded notices are what I've seen work.
Yeah, and I've had a situation in Nebraska where we had a property owner that was, you know, not so much opposed to putting a deed restriction on their property. They're just dragging their feet and not doing it. It was bogging down the whole process. So EPA was about to actually, as Mike discussed, actually put a notice on the deed specifically to make that happen. Fortunately, they came through and actually did it themselves, but that was a method we were looking into conducting.
Okay, and does any other trainer have any thoughts on that?
This is Kevin Chums from Eagle. I've seen it happen where, you know, under the leaking underground storage tank program, the statute set up many years ago was set up in a iterative process way where the restrictive covenant was the primary method to address the remaining risks. And if it was determined to be impractical to file a restriction or, you know, let's say 10 or 15 restrictions, depending on the size of the plume, then the party could use something else like a groundwater ordinance. But, you know, that's been a challenge for owners and operators of underground storage tank systems. So the statute was amended to allow for individuals to pick and choose which instrument best fits their situation. They don't have to pursue the deed restriction option first if another option is available.
All right. Thank you, trainers, for answering that question. We have two more in the chat, and then we'll move on with our training today. Are IC breaches typically associated with property transfers and perhaps developers motivated to overlook unfamiliar restrictions that aren't liens? I'm not sure if I said that right.
Liens, yeah. I'll go first, if that's okay. I actually think it's the opposite in my experience. I think breaches typically occur in between property transfers, not not in the process of a transaction. That's because, you know, the EPA's all appropriate inquiries rule and just the property transaction process in general tends to uncover all of the things, all the environmental issues. And unless a developer is being, you know, fraudulent or very irresponsible, they tend to abide by them. It's the years in between when pipes are getting repaired or, you know, a basement's getting built or whatever, where there are issues, in my experience.
Yeah, there can be an over-reliance on just institutional knowledge sometimes, and that tends to, over the years, people start to forget, out of sight, out of mind. So,
yeah, and I agree. We see that a lot in areas where there's a lot of construction, where there are emergency utility repairs, where people are putting in new drinking water wells. And we'll be touching on a couple of those examples in this presentation as well. So, although it seems that when you talk about institutional controls to the public, they typically, or just to, you know, even environmental professionals, we often do relate those breaches to those property transfers, because I think for some reason that's where we hear about them more. But they, you know, in my experience, it's more the construction or, you know, the physical actions that trigger those breaches.
All right. Thank you, trainers. Next question. Is a deed notice ultimately enforceable?
Hmm. I could go first on that. I mean, I hate to, if someone else wants to go by all means, but I'll put my lawyer hat on for this one. And I could say it kind of depends on what you mean by enforceable. Under property law, which is how covenants are enforced, a deed notice is probably not directly enforceable because it's just simply, it's there to provide notice. But generally speaking, the notice is provided by a state or federal environmental agency who has different, not property law, but environmental law ways to enforce whatever is being noticed about. So if the notice says, you know, hey, there's residual contamination here, the notice is probably is going to say something like, subject to federal law X or state law Y, if you do something, we could exercise our enforcement action. So it's not enforceable the way a covenant is under the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act, for example, but there typically are some ultimate ways to enforce it.
All right, thank you, Michael. We have one last question, then we'll move on. Is there any guidance for the implementation of institutional controls, sign placement, property owner access permission for a constructed in-water remedy, i.e. armored cap, where U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and U.S. Coast Guard are also involved?
Well, I guess that would be part of your planning and implementation to process and identifying it. So yeah, there's different ways to maintain awareness of that, and signage or something could be some way to do that in that situation. I mean, I guess you've got some issues with it being in underwater, but I guess I'm sure you could put some signs and whatnot. That's just part of the exploration of what your communication methods are and what would be best to put on there to get the word out.
I might recommend that this person email us trainers sometime after the training session, because this seems like it might be a site-specific issue with some very detailed background that we may need to know to fully answer this question.
Yeah, I agree. I'll just say, like, when I see underwater things, I often think those are easier to deal with because the Army Corps 404 permitting process is normally something you can kind of lean on to make sure that whatever's being put in place there is, you know, not going to be impacted in the future. But anyway, that's a vague answer to a specific question, like was mentioned. So I agree, more facts are needed for sure.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So, and thank you, attendees, for putting those questions in the chat for us. With that, we're going to move on to the next section, which I believe is Michael's.
Yes, that's me. I know it. Do I have the little?
You do now. I might have advanced one too far for you.
Yeah, okay. I'm just waiting for my arrows. Okay, there they are. Yeah, okay. So I'm going to be talking about monitoring and performance evaluation, hopefully within my 20 minute or less allotment. And so far, as you know, we've heard about outreach and registries, all of which are critical, but they all rely on the basic philosophy of, like, well, if you tell people or make information available to people, and kind of everything will work out. But we all know that life's not perfect. So monitoring and evaluation, an affirmative monitoring approach is needed and is in place by many states. And as your survey questions already pointed out, IC monitoring matters. So I'm going to talk about best practices and so forth amongst the states based on, you know, our ITRC survey work. What do I mean? You know, IC monitoring is a collection of a bunch of information at sites, and performance evaluation is just taking that information and making some sense of it. But that's vague. So more specifically, just to be clear about what IC monitoring is, first, you got to remember what the types of institutional control requirements normally are. We've talked about a lot of them today already. No groundwater use, no excavation or residential use, et cetera. Just a bunch of no's, no things you can't do. So what IC monitoring is not, it's not conventional environmental monitoring. It's not soil sampling or groundwater sampling. But what it is the collection is the collection of data and information about the use of property where the IC exists to make sure that the user activity to learn whether there's user activities that might violate the IC requirements. In other words, trying to find out what's going on to make sure it's not the wrong thing, like the wells, the excavations, the daycares, etc. I'm going to be talking about the six approaches that we uncovered during our ITRC work that state agencies commonly employ, but as a sidebar, so do many private companies. And they include state just boots on the ground state agency inspections, boots on the ground inspections required by the obligated party, usually the property owner, excavation monitoring through the one call system or similar systems, other types of land activity monitoring, and local government coordination. We heard a little bit of discussion about that already, and some state IC permit programs. Related to all of this, just as an FYI, EPA has advanced monitoring for institutional control document linked here, which really talks about more the third, fourth, fifth categories here that are not the conventional boots on the ground, but some of the more advanced technologies, which I'll be describing. Survey, which I think, Devin, you need to take back, right? Which of the following do you utilize for monitoring institutional controls of the six that I mentioned? The boots on either one of the first two, boots on ground inspections, or more remote or electronic-based inspections through one call, land activity monitoring, or reliance on local government coordination, or some sort of institutional control permit process. So Devin, I can't see the answers loading. So when you feel, you know, when you feel like they're there, feel free to end it.
Yeah, I'm just gonna give it a few more seconds, and then I'll broadcast them.
Okay. Well, while people are pressing, in our last version of this, I used to be able to see all the inputs coming in, which was fun. So usually what we see is, this. So the conventional approaches of boots on the ground still are the most common, which is not surprising. You know, visiting the sites, performing the inspections, but the other types of what I kind of think are more advanced institutional control monitoring approaches are growing in prominence, and you kind of see that exemplified here. So moving on. Approach number one, very basic, I think, or very conceptually basic, not that, you know, nothing's easy, but this is easy at least to understand. Inspections are scheduled by the state agency. Often there's a standard form. Agency staff goes out and visits. This is usually done by state agencies, not federal. Inspection dates are recorded in a database. Sometimes those databases are made public, but it's just like your classic in monitoring and enforcement approach to periodically visit and assess for yourself whether the institutional control is being abided by. Approach number two is very similar, and actually I think growing more common, where instead of doing it themselves, agencies, particularly with inside of the actual language of the environmental covenant, are requiring obligated party, usually the property owner, to go out and do it themselves and report back to the agency. Some states create their own forms, some don't. Some agencies send annual reminder letters. They track the receipt of the certifications. And then if you don't, that's when they start paying more attention to you. In the process of this, ownership changes are also captured, which is always tricky for the states to keep track of, because these institutional controls tend to need to be implemented or at least operated by the owner. And as ownership changes, then the state's relationship to the site changes. So that gets tracked usually through this process as well. So there's details that can get complicated, but conceptually those approaches are fairly straightforward and still very common. One of the approaches that is growing in popularity is the approach versus the one call. So just a quick sidebar into background, the one call systems exist anyway, and they have for a long time. They exist like this. The underground facility owners, gas, electric, water people, need to join these state systems. There's one in every state. And then based on them joining, they tell the 811 system, hey, I have these lines, and here they are. The excavators are required by law to call the 811 system and go, hey, I'm excavating over here. Are there any lines? The 811 system acts as a clearinghouse. It takes the call from the excavator, looks at the registered lines, and gets back to the excavator. Well, it bridges the gap between these two people so that the underground facility owners report back and say, all clear, or hey, it's not all clear. We're going to go paint a line for you. And then they do, and they paint a line for them. And then that way the excavator doesn't hit the gas line. That system has been in existence. And so the environmental world has been leveraging that to work basically the same. And instead of an underground line being registered into the one call system, basically a cleanup site is. Sometimes the cleanup sites also have underground lines. So it's like it's kind of exactly the same thing. Sometimes the cleanup sites have less underground lines and more contamination. In any case, excavator calls, finds out what's going on. And rather than paint a big environmental area, the process usually involves sending an electronic piece of information over to the excavator. This is still close to accurate. But I know personally that this is growing a little bit, but there's at least 9-10 states using this. And then a lot of private sector people as well. In summary, you have to connect into the 811 system. And then an email, a text advisories, like I said, warn the excavator. And ordinarily, these approaches are not things that states or private sectors just do by themselves. There's some outsourcing involved, some third-party intermediaries help make this all happen for states or for private sectors, actors. So that's approach number three. This is a quick example of in Delaware how that electronic notice looks like. This is the acts in lieu of painting the line. This advisory goes over to a person and tells them, hey, you're about to dig. There's a big environmental site you're inside of, and here's some information about it and some people to contact for more details. And when the state has a registry, just FYI, those advisories are even that much better, because then they can just say, here's a link to our registry. Go look up the site and you can see all the details about the area you're about to excavate into. And then, as Lynn Bailey knows, in Hawaii, I'm personally working in that, and Hawaii has that same approach where they can rely on their registry, and it's pretty cool. Okay, approach number four relies on basically a connection into an electronic feed of land activity. So it's like virtual site inspections, basically, or COVID style. Maybe that's not a good joke, but contactless inspections, where instead of going and visiting a site once a year, this approach gives an electronic feed of land activity information weekly, monthly, maybe even daily, about all the things that you would maybe see if you were doing a manual process and visiting the site. You would look for permits and ownership changes and development applications and new child cares, new water wells, and things like that all get sent through this approach automatically to people, and filtered to find which is affecting your site, and then alerts go and say, hey, there's an activity on your property or on a property that you regulate that could pose an issue to your institutional control. And so there are a lot of states using this method as well. It tends to be useful when you're a state with hundreds of sites. It's difficult to keep a hands on all of them, but with an electronic approach like this, there's a lot of visibility as to activity at institutional control sites. This is also very common, or at least growing in common in popularity. Connection to local government. I think you heard Kevin say earlier that had their state done a better job of connecting the state information with the local public health department, the public health probably wouldn't have issued a water well. And that's probably true. That approach. Is what I call minimum coordinations, where the state, and not just I call, this is what's out there in the real world. And these little red things are my personal phrases for them. But minimum coordination is basically when a state agency informs local governments about the IC stuff. And that can be very effective, because otherwise they're not going to know and they're going to issue permits kind of flying blind. So that's the minimal set of coordination that you see. And when it gets more advanced, when there's an eyes and ears approach, where the local government not only knows about what the state has, but feeds information back to the state, maybe weekly or monthly, and says, thanks for telling me about your 20 institutional controls in our city. Here's the permit applications we've received for those 20 institutional controls, you know, so you guys can go do what you need to do about this. We as a local government, we're not gonna enforce your environmental laws, but we're at least gonna tell you what's going on. So if there's an issue, that's an eyes and ears approach. And then sometimes local governments, particularly when the local government is largely impacted by like a really big site, Superfund site, they will take ownership over the whole thing and enact their own ordinance and enforce it. And sometimes they're even called institutional control ordinances. So that's an approach as well, which can be very, very good. Sometimes these approaches is everything that's needed. Sometimes sometimes states use three or four of the six approaches, you know, together. So eyes and ears is just a quick example. Denver does this. They take in the information from the state and they send them a monthly set of permits, which kind of looks like this, building permits, so that the state can at least look at them and know what's going on at their sites, at the institution control sites that they regulate, and see if there's any issues. There's many, and this is one example we pulled up during the guidance document development of Jasper County that developed an environmental contamination ordinance. It's basically an institutional control ordinance that makes sure people don't dig deep beneath I think below maybe a foot under which the soil is still contaminated all throughout the jurisdiction, basically. Lead smelter, if I remember correctly. One other approach, IC permit. Really only one state is doing this, but we still showcase it because we felt like it was going to be a trend. That was 5 years ago, so maybe it's not, but it's still, I think, a unique example where instead of just requiring property owners or responsible parties to do inspections, there's this, the permit example builds a whole permit process around it. So if you want an institutional control, you have to apply for a permit and pay every 2 years. I think it's every 2 years to keep the permit active. And part of that process involves you certifying to the agency, in this case in New Jersey, through a licensed site professional, that the institutional controls, whether they're deed notice or classification exception area, which basically means soil or groundwater, in New Jersey, whether they are operating correctly. And then if there's engineering controls involved, you know, caps and so forth, there's some financial insurance requirements part of the permit. So it's a formalization of inspection requirements through a permit process. When we went back in 2015, when we looked at what everybody was actually doing, we found that many states are combining approaches. Some didn't respond to us, but many did. And we saw kind of a mix of one approach to five out of the six being implemented. And this is just a snippet of some examples of what was happening in Pennsylvania. They were requiring the landowner certifications and doing their own. So they were doing the first two of the six, if you remember, whereas Colorado was doing the first two, and they're adding on that coordination that I told you about. And then Idaho was doing some landowner certifications and their own inspections, but also doing with the one call and the land use and activity monitoring. And then California was, you know, layering on all five approaches. So, there are other states doing things, of course, but this gives you a representative example of kind of how different states take different approaches based on what they feel is, you know, works. And a quick assessment of those. They all have the other six. There's some pros and cons really to both. The first two are, I think, obvious in that they're snapshot approaches. So in a sense, they're comprehensive at the time, but a lot of things happen during 1 year or 2 year timeframes, or even 5 year timeframes for these boots on the ground inspections. And even though they're relatively conventional and maybe easy, they still require agency staff and resources. Excavation View One Call is powerful in that it's daily, or close to daily, constant flow of information about your site. But it's, you know, excavation is mostly about soil. Although sometimes excavation does detect water well installations, but it requires a third party service. It's not as easy as just sending he or she out to go and do an inspection. land activity monitoring, similar as excavation, you get a lot of information frequently, and it's tailored, and so it gives a lot of good visibility, but still it takes some, it typically takes some doing to get it up and running. Coordination with local governments is very good, although it just depends on the local government. Some local governments are pretty receptive, and sometimes they basically go, hey, we don't have the resources or the technical know-how to do that. And in that case of Denver that I told you about, it wasn't easy for them to establish that connection between the state and the local government. They had to sign an MOA, and it was quite a process. So, you know, all these things have pros and cons, and they're all useful, which is why they tend to be layered by states, or like I said, by private companies doing the same thing with their portfolios. And then when deciding on which one or all six to use, you know, what I see is that it depends. Like if you are a state or a big property owner with, say, 100 institutional controls or 300 institutional controls, you're probably going to find that a third of them are fine to go out and visit every few years. That's all that you really need. And then the other third are going to really need maybe three or four pieces of monitoring altogether because of the potential for harm and compared with the potential for a breach. In other words, is it likely for something to happen? And when something happens, is the potential for harm great? And so you see sites, just to give you some quick examples, where all that's really restricted is that everything's fine, just don't build houses here. That's pretty easy to monitor. And then there's some that go, everything's fine, but there's seven pieces of requirements. You can't dig below 10 feet. You can't have a water well. You can't have anything, you know, that's not an industrial use. And the list tends to go on. And any excavation has to be reported to the agency. You have to get a plan approved before you move any dirt. And those types of complicated ones are the ones that typically need more monitoring. Finally, getting into performance evaluation, just to start wrapping up in the next two or three slides. Once all that monitoring basically gives a lot of information, you either get it once a year or you get it all the time. And the evaluation goes, okay, are the results typically in a finding of institutional controls being effective? That's terrific. Sometimes there's some compliance issues, obviously, that can range from very small, like administrative, your report was a week late, to very major, like Kevin was saying, you put a well in and you weren't supposed to, or that the monitoring approach is too much or too little, or that you don't need the IC anymore. Somebody asked a question about that, and that triggers a process for terminating and re-recording an institutional control or otherwise, you know, rippling through the process to get that thing removed, or full enforcement, which Kevin's going to talk about shortly. So that's, you know, all that monitoring makes all of this possible. And without it, agencies really are blind. One of the best practices, as a little bit of a sidebar, that we found during the guidance document development, is that, you know, agencies are begun looking at stewardship the way they've been looking at site cleanup for a long time, meaning that it's a thing. It needs internal policies. It needs people. It needs staff. It's not just an esoteric issue. So we do see, and we've seen even since back when we wrote this guidance document, more and more infrastructure and documents being built up inside the states to steward, to help monitor and enforce the stewardship program. And finally, how much does this all cost? Always a big question, particularly people at the state level want to know about, and it's always complicated. SWAMO has put together a document that helps make some sense of things. They list the cost elements over the life cycle of an IC, from planning all the way to enforcement, which we found made sense. That's a whole thing that I can't talk about right now, but the point is that implementing a monitoring and enforcement program is a lot more than just, you know, doing an inspection every once in a while. It starts with planning, and it lives for a long time. And then the way states recover those fees, if once they're able to figure out what they are, varies in two major ways. There's an upfront process where states charge you one time. It's like, hey, if you really want an institutional control, you got to pay us, because we're gonna have to deal with this thing for a long time. In the case of Missouri, last time I looked, the regulation was allowing for $15K upfront cost. The other approach is like a pay-as-you-go approach, where New Jersey, like I said earlier, with the permits, or California inside its regulations, and then ultimately inside of the covenants that it issues, says that you can have an institutional control if you want, But if we have to monitor it, we're going to send you a bill for whatever it takes us to keep on top of your institutional control. And that's how states, how some states collect the fees. With that, I am wrapping up and move over to where monitoring leads you, which is enforcement.
All right. Thanks, Mike. I am working as a group with a university with my state agency in looking at costs associated with institutional controls, especially regarding groundwater. So it'll be interesting to see what the project results are and what types of implications come out of that document. So as Mike said, before we get to the survey, I just want to go back slide here. Oops. There we go. I'm sure many of you on the phone or at your computer are those in the technical world making sure that all the appropriate exposure pathways are adequately defined and addressed by the chosen institutional control. Now, as a staff member myself who works as a liaison with the Department of Attorney General in the state of Michigan and the technical project managers, I may be contacted when the enforceability or enforcement of institutional control comes into question. That has happened over the years, and we've had to engage with folks in our legal department so that way we can work with the property owner and gain compliance with the deed restriction. So for this portion of the presentation, I'm going to highlight many of the enforcement tools that ITRC has developed to be considered when planning, implementing, and approving the type of institutional control that is best suited for the selected remedy. Again, even the regulated community will benefit from this part of the guidance because having the understanding of the enforcement process for your state will provide you with an understanding of the overall enforcement process, tie those principles to how it works in your state, so your transparency and know what's going to happen and be able to work through those enforcement issues. Talk about if there's any ways that you can respond. Okay, so ITRC's survey illustrates weaknesses in state monitoring and compliance efforts. If adequate management and monitoring requirements that Mike Swinski just talked about are not established as part of the state IC program, then there's going to be little to enforce. Indeed, our survey results indicated that approximately 2/3 of state agencies never have taken an enforcement action against a responsible party regarding institutional control. This is a significant statistic to keep in mind because we know that failures and violations of ICs do happen. Overall, the data amplifies the necessary relationship between adequate IC management tools and the foundation they provide to an overall meaningful enforcement program. Okay, so time to stretch our fingers for an enforcement poll question. Does the state you represent or where you have implemented in institutional control have an enforcement process in hand if the IC violation is identified, regardless of whether there's been an enforcement action taken? And in addition to the traditional yes or no, we do have the not sure option. Okay, the results are showing most of the folks are not sure, which is not uncommon because, you know, oftentimes there isn't a specific enforcement program or enforcement statutory provision perhaps listed in your laws that discuss, you know, enforcement of institutional control when something happens. And then there are folks that do have mechanisms in place. So that's great too. Okay, so I've previously touched upon the concepts and challenges of considering enforceability during the planning and implementation phases of institutional controls. And Mike Swinski also just covered the importance of monitoring as part of a long-term management program. In addition to these two challenges, what ITRC offers as possible solutions in its guidance is to identify the proper parties to enforce the provisions of an institutional control, which can be complex and complicated. And even though ICs are most commonly tied to laws independently administered by state and local jurisdictions, many states may not have explicit authorities written into their respective statutes, as I was indicating with the poll. Add into the uniqueness of native land and federal facilities. Another challenge is there is no current model framework to act as guidance for compliance and enforcement strategies, specifically for institutional controls. And finally, the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act is a model statute that can be adopted into law to provide legal framework to create, modify, enforce, and terminate a institutional control specific to covenants, but the model language only provides for the conventional common law relief, such as trespass or nuisance once a violation occurs, and does not provide that compliance assistance framework that many state regulators seek to use first. ITRC's guidance document recognizes the challenges to enforcement of ICs and discusses the various legal authorities beyond the traditional statutory dependents that regulators and other parties responsible for assuring compliance may use. For example, in my state, the laws require that the environmental covenants contain a provision granting the department the ability to enforce the restrictive covenant by legal action in a court of appropriate jurisdiction. Instruments such as consent decrees document an administrative or judicial court's approval of the settlement of an enforcement case filed in court. Typically, consent decrees specify actions to be taken or not to be taken by the settling parties. Consent decrees may have penalties attached for noncompliance as well. So there's tools in the toolbox that we can use as part of our enforcement. Now, because there is no common model legal framework for ICs, the ITRC guidance document suggests that the construction of the basic IC enforcement model can be premised on the traditional environmental enforcement models that's used for water, air, and waste. When IC compliance failure occurs, enforcement can be strategically applied towards the party's compliance, deter any future violations, and assure the protection of receptors from the threat of release or exposure. The ITRC guidance document suggests that voluntary compliance methods emphasize enforcement avoidance, as well as intervention to educate a party on how to comply with IC requirements. You know, a lot of that goes to, you know, the outreach portion or perhaps monitoring programs, and either the property has transacted or, you know, the same owner has been there for many years, but, you know, things are forgotten over time. In contrast, requiring involuntary compliance from a party through the formal enforcement is generally considered a final administrative measure to resolve IC violations. Failing to respond to informal enforcement measures, violations with significant environmental impact, or those parties, unfortunately, with a history of noncompliance may generally be considered for formal enforcement. The ITRC's guidance document emphasizes that effective enforcement of an institutional control depends on thoughtful IC planning. Enforcement action may be considered when IC requirements have not been observed, have not been implemented or fail to meet the requirements, have not been adequately maintained or monitored, fail to have required certifications, perhaps, or fail to meet the reporting requirements that are either contained in the document itself or the governing laws. Now, once a violation is identified through monitoring, inspection, reporting, or an IC performance evaluation, the entity who can enforce can then choose either the informal or formal phase previously described. The ITRC guidance document describes the potentially available tools for your agency when seeking to choose the informal voluntary compliance assistance approach. Voluntary compliance actions may take many forms and will vary from state to state. Examples include an informal correction letter, a request for corrective or compliance action, a deficiency letter, or an inspection report that identifies one or more issues concerning IC requirements. In my state, we've taken the approach similar to what the state of Kansas has with a compliance evaluation checklist, and we document all of the situations at the site, include photographs and a cover letter. And if there is a significant issue, that'll especially be noted with further follow-up, but otherwise it just provides a generic overview of the results accompanied with a specific checklist. Materials that support the informal enforcement action can be provided to further support the action and to assist the obligated party in fully understanding the violation. These materials include the inspection reports, photographs, maps, and copies of relevant regulations or laws. It's always handy to hand them the actual institutional control. Now, in the event that the party fails to respond to voluntary compliance measures or fails in any requirement for corrective action within a specified schedule, violations with significant environmental impact or the obligated parties with a history of noncompliance may generally be considered for a notice of violation correspondence without the benefit of voluntary compliance measures. Formal administrative enforcement measures may include administrative orders, civil judicial action, and in the most serious cases, criminal action. Just wait for the screen to advance. Okay, so I understand the enforcement process may be a little challenging to put all together. So ITRC guidance document includes real-world case study examples. One such example takes place in Massachusetts. For a brief timeline, between approximately 1919 and the late 1980s, a building occupied the property with light manufacturing operations. Between 1989 and 1990, property assessment identified oil-stained soils with PCE and PCE-contaminated groundwater. Remedial actions did not satisfy unrestricted residential use, and so in 1995, a notice of activity and use limitation, which is ASTM's restrictive covenant or deed restriction synonym, was recorded with the local Register of Deeds office. The Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection may audit any property for which an activity and use limitation was recorded. So in May of 2012, the state agency observed soil disturbance and stockpiled soil on the property. A few months later, the soil samples collected and analyzed detected concentrations of PCE and extractable petroleum hydrocarbons. The earth-moving activities by the tenant at the site were observed without a required health and safety plan or a soil management plan, both violations of the activity and use limitation. Now, Massachusetts law provides for administrative penalties of up to $25,000 per day for failure to comply with terms of an activity and use limitation. That is quite a number, quite a deterrent. In this case, the state agency assessed a penalty of approximately $5,600 and negotiated an agreement with the property owner to record an amended activity and use limitation to address violations described in the what happened and pay $4,000 in penalties while the rest were held in abeyance. So there is some wiggle room for enforcement discretion. Massachusetts authorizes an administrative enforcement framework that begins with the issuance of compliance assistance letters to property owners who have a notice of activity use limitation on the property deed. Failures identified through the audit program to comply with the activity and use limitation is a failure to comply with Massachusetts law, and enforcement action may be initiated, as happened in this case. So a takeaway for you is planning for IC enforcement action should take place at the time site-specific IC requirements are developed. And this is to carefully evaluate the enforceability, interested parties, jurisdictional requirements, and methods of enforcement action. Enforcement planning should occur as early as development of a long-term stewardship plan, which Lynn Bailey from the state of Hawaii will now introduce.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm actually with EPA now. When I started this training, I was working for the Department of Health in Hawaii and their Hazard Evaluation and Emergency Response Office. But now I'm with EPA's Region 9 Superfund Division. This is the piece of the presentation that ties all the pieces of the IC life cycle together. All these lines and arrows that you see come together in the long-term stewardship portion of the IC life cycle. So before we move forward, I'm going to touch on a few definitions. As Kevin mentioned in the early slides, an institutional control or an IC, according to our team glossary, is a legal or administrative restriction on the use of or access to a site or facility to eliminate or minimize potential exposure to chemicals of concern. And I'm mentioning this because it's key to keep in mind that our team document and this training assume that that IC is already in place. Long-term stewardship or long-term maintenance, as Doug discussed earlier, is required to ensure that the IC remains protective of human health and the environment throughout the full IC life cycle. And that's the focus of this entire training and also the team document. The long-term stewardship plan or the LTS plan is the instruction book of long-term stewardship requirements, and that's the focus of this next section. All right, so I really want to thank that audience member who discussed when IC failures occur, because I think most of us do typically think of these IC failures occurring when a property is transferred. We realize, oh shoot, that building shouldn't have been there. But you know, we've had several examples throughout this presentation, including in that last enforcement section and in the earlier section where we were talking about installing wells. And I think a lot of us have seen it on construction sites where that soil gets used someplace where it shouldn't have been used because it was contaminated. So here's an example of an IC breach that happened in Hawaii. These photos are from a location that needed emergency utility repairs, and it's an area with known contamination and contamination that's obvious when it's encountered. The first utility company showed up and began dewatering, and you can see the inlet hoses for the pumps in this photo here on the upper left-hand corner, but you don't really see where the outlets are going. Now, unfortunately, there was no frac tank or pump truck at the output end of those hoses. The hoses drained to a grassy median, then flowed to the street and into a storm drain. And in Hawaii, as you see on the upper right-hand corner of this slide, storm drains lead directly into the ocean. So Hawaii's state on-scene coordinators, our emergency responders, became aware of the release when someone called to report a large sheen in the harbor. Never a situation you want to be in. At the time of the release, there was no long-term stewardship plan. An LTS plan or a long-term stewardship plan shows where the contamination is, what it is, and how to manage it. Had there been a good long-term stewardship plan and had all the stakeholders had access to it, that larger issue or those larger issues could have been prevented. The release to the ocean, the fines from the state and federal government, and all that negative public attention. So as Kevin mentioned, in spite of the importance of maintaining long-term stewardship of ICs, the ITR survey found that only 52% of responding states require some sort of long-term stewardship plan. So our team developed a template to create a solid long-term stewardship plan and a tool to help you create the plan of your own. The long-term stewardship plan is written after the institutional control is in place, and it functions much like an operations and maintenance and management plan or an EPA IC implementation and assurance plan. A good long-term stewardship plan will pull together the requirements of the institutional control, including any of those engineering controls management requirements that were discussed earlier as well. It's also a comprehensive guide for monitoring all the different aspects of the ICs. A good long-term stewardship plan delegates who's responsible for the different steps in monitoring, reporting, and enforcing the IC. The poll at the beginning of today's presentation found that about 62% of you experience IC failure due to inadequate communication, and another 39% attributed IC failure to inadequate monitoring. For ICs to be effective, stakeholders must understand their responsibilities. The ultimate goal is to keep the requirements of the IC in place long-term to protect human health and the environment, even when all the people who initially implemented the IC are no longer part of that project. The writer and keepers of long-term stewardship plans will likely vary by state, but in general, obligated parties write in. In some instances, regulatory agencies may choose to write the plans. For instance, in Hawaii, state agencies have written a form of long-term stewardship plan to manage old sites with historical contamination within public rights of way where the obligated party or the responsible party is no longer identifiable. Now, this slide shows a small subset of people who should keep the long-term stewardship plan, but a more complete list was shown on slide 21, and that includes names. Includes stakeholders like tenants and adjacent property owners. The long-term stewardship plan should also be easily available to the public upon request. Generally, the more people who are aware of the locations of institutional controls and the requirements of the institutional controls, the more likely we are to maintain the integrity of the ICs and protect human health and the environment. Although the task of writing a long-term stewardship plan may seem daunting, it's not as complicated as you may think. All the historical information needed to set the stage for a successful long-term stewardship plan can be found in the site closure documents, like records of decision, for instance, as well as the IC document itself. The same documents that Michael discussed as being important for performance evaluation are the documents that we need to create the long-term stewardship plan. Some of them are listed here, but different states and different programs have different types of documents that can be good resources. Additionally, some ICs are interim ICs for sites where remediation is pending or in progress. In that case, you would pull information from finalized characterization reports like remedial investigation reports or feasibility studies, characterization reports, whatever you have that has good final data in it, as well as from the interim IC document itself. The long-term stewardship plan will build on the information in these documents to tie it into the components such as monitoring, registry, outreach, and enforcement that the team discussed earlier. So our team created an example site called Easement to show how simple it can be to create an effective long-term stewardship plan. This site was brought to our attention when the tenants of the casting yard northwest of the site were excavating across a pipeline to put in some wiring for some lighting. It's a fairly open area surrounded by industrial land. It's a small rectangular area with institutional controls for observed free product, groundwater contamination, and soil contamination. For our easement long-term stewardship plan, we pulled some figures from the historical documents we already discussed directly into the plan, including standard figures like site plans with labeled areas of concerns and institutional control boundaries. Contaminant figures showing delineated contaminant of concern boundaries and affected media. We also pulled other information from tables and text into those documents, like site background information, past, current, and anticipated future site use, and summary of other investigations, like all the impacted media, all the sources of chemical releases, chemicals of concern, applicable screening levels, and exceedances. Now here's an example of a figure that we pulled into our long-term stewardship plan from historical documents. The utility excavation where the contamination was initially identified is shown in red. Five horizontal dotted lines are pipelines, which indicate potential sources of the contamination. That green rectangle surrounding the site is the area bounded by the institutional controls. Coordinates of the IC boundary are shown in call-out boxes at the corners of the controlled area. The property boundary of the easement is near the middle of the site, and that's shown by a dashed black line. A road cuts through to the southwest. The boundary of soil contamination above screening levels is shown in orange. Now, this is a very simplified map for the presentation. Your long-term stewardship plan contaminant figure most likely will have additional details like call-out boxes with contaminant concentrations, steps to contaminants, etc. For easement, the long-term stewardship plan will contain additional maps clearly delineating the groundwater and the free product contamination at this particular site. Since easement only has one area of concern with one type of IC, this simple type of map is sufficient. But you might have a site that has multiple IC boundaries with different types of contamination, different types of restrictions. So ensure that your long-term stewardship plan figures clearly show all those boundaries and the contaminants within each. Now, although the technical aspects of contamination management at this site seem simple, the management responsibility is not clear. There's a pipeline easement with two separate companies responsible for the pipelines. The casting yard is run by another company who leases this portion of land from a large landowner in the area. The contamination was discovered when that casting yard crew excavated in the easement to put in some lights. Now, if that scenario isn't complicated enough, at the time of the discovery, the large landowner was finalizing a sale of the land to a new owner. It's important for the long-term stewardship plan to identify all these stakeholders and clarify which is responsible for each step of the monitoring and reporting into the future. So stakeholders can be a complicated discussion. On slide 25, Doug Burge discussed how effective communication and outreach between stakeholders can increase IC success. Yet the majority of outreach is to the current landowner. On slide 33, Carol discussed many other stakeholders who should have access to IC information. And table 5 of the team document lists a large variety of stakeholders who must be considered during the life cycle of a successful IC. The life cycle of the ICs may be very long. Often the responsible party needs to implement most of the long-term ICs or ECs, engineering controls, monitoring, and maintenance. As Michael noted on slide 56, often states are taking on the responsibility of monitoring their ICs. Sometimes there are layered ICs that are overseen by local and state governments. There may be site-specific responsibilities that could fall through the cracks. As we write the long-term stewardship plan, the roles and responsibilities of each stakeholder must be clearly defined throughout the remaining life cycle of the IC. These responsibilities may include monitoring and performance evaluations, enforcement, and even modification and termination. So when there are so many parties involved with a property that has ICs, how can we ensure that the integrity of the institutional controls will continue to protect human health and the environment well into the future? There's an app for that. So the long-term stewardship tool itself functions like an old choose-your-own-adventure book. If any of you guys are old school like me, you might remember those where you'd flip through and you'd read, come to the end of a page and you'd see, you'd get a choice. And depending on which choice you chose, you'd go to a different page of the book. Within the tool, you answer questions, and the answers you give open up other questions or filter out questions that aren't relevant to your site. The long-term stewardship tool allows users to generate a long-term stewardship plan, which can be further edited to smooth the language, add or delete information, or improve its functionality. After generating the document, coordinate with your local regulators to ensure that the long-term stewardship plan meets all regulatory requirements. So to begin, you'll click on the link within the team document on the ITRC webpage to download the tool. And we'll give you that link at the end of this section of the presentation. Within a zip file, you'll see a folder called IC_tool. And a PDF document called README First. Open the README First file and you'll see step-by-step instructions for saving and opening the tool. These instructions will save you from errors and frustration later, so please refer to them before using the tool. They can also be used to help troubleshoot any issues you encounter while using the tool. One error that we encountered as we were building the long-term stewardship tool resulted when people ran into the, when people ran the tool from within the zip file without extracting it. So in order to avoid that error, the README First file instructs you to drag the IC tool file to your desktop before you open it. Now you'll see an extracted folder called IC_tool on your desktop. Now, the name of this file is somewhat misleading, and I apologize for that. We should reiterate that the tool will be used to create a long-term stewardship plan, not an IC. Please remember, this ITRC guidance assumes that IC is already in place and actually will help form your answers on this tool. The tool will help you define the process to manage the requirements of the IC to ensure that the IC remains protective of human health and the environment throughout the full IC lifecycle. Open the IC_tool folder, and you will see a folder called Images, a folder called Templates, and an Excel file called IC_tool. Now it's important, please keep all of these files and folders together as they're packaged. Changing the folder or file names or moving files and folders, you know, outside of the, if you move the subfolders or the file out of the main folder, it'll hinder the functionality of the tool while you're using it. Later on, you'll be able to do so, and I'll let you know when it's okay. Click the IC_tool Excel file to open. For many users, the tool table of contents will pop up immediately after you open the Excel file. If so, your screen will look like the next slide. Other users may need to enable editing, enable content, and or configure Excel to trust VBA the first time you use the tool. The README First file will show you how to do this, but once those steps are complete, your screen will look like this. Also, if you're in the middle of using the tool and you have to close it to do something else and come back to it later, when you reopen the tool to work on it later, you will see this screen. So click here to get started, and it'll send you to the form page where you left off. You can click Reset Answers, and it'll clear all the previous entries, and it'll return you to the beginning so you can start over for a new project. So the first time you use the tool, whether you got here from click here to get started or whether the tool autos opens, you'll see the tool table of contents. Just click next and go to the next slide. So you'll see a blank form and you'll notice the four buttons at the bottom. During any time in the process of answering questions and creating your long-term stewardship plan, you can return to the previous page of questions or look at the table of contents. The button that's marked next is used to advance the tool to the next set of questions in the form. However, before you can move to that next set of questions, you need to make sure that any question that's marked with a red asterisk has been answered. You won't be able to click next until all of those have been completed. As you answer the questions, fill in the information appropriate for your site and write as if you are writing a document. Use the information and the decisions that are written in the IC documentation and the site closure documents. If there's an interim IC and remediation is ongoing or pending, use the information in the interim IC and existing finalized characterization reports. In some cases, the answers you provide in one question on this form or in this tool will fill into more than one location in that long-term stewardship plan you're creating. So be careful not to use sentence fragments or abbreviations, unless there's an abbreviation that you might want to use multiple times throughout your long-term stewardship plan. In that case, you may want to enter it as an abbreviation and go back and define the acronym later. You will also be able to upload figures into the tool that will be inserted into the document. And again, choose these figures from existing site documentation if you'd like. Whenever you'd like to check your work, click on the preview button in the lower right-hand corner of each section of the form. The preview button will allow you to see how your information has been filled into the template LTS plan, and then you can make corrections within the tool if you wish. The answers you gave to questions within the tool will be highlighted wherever the text auto-filled into the long-term stewardship plan you're creating. You'll notice the highlighted text imported into the plan exactly as I wrote it in the form, including the abbreviations. Based on reviewer comments, if users did not answer some questions in the tool, we created the preview so it will display a highlighted question not answered within the template. Our easement site is technically fairly simple with just one area with institutional controls. However, if you have a property with different institutional controls in different areas, you can use the long-term stewardship tool to create a plan that will work in multiple areas. Just select yes for the second, third, or fourth areas as needed. You will then be led through a series of questions about which types of contamination are controlled with institutional controls and engineering controls within each of the areas. Michael discussed the importance of monitoring and performance evaluation and gave some examples on slide 43. The long-term stewardship tool asks questions in the monitoring section that tie back to the institutional controls and the engineering controls requirements specified in earlier questions in the forms in the LTS tool. This section of the tool helps you choose what types of monitoring are required, who is responsible for the monitoring, how to report the results, and how frequently to monitor and who to report to. After completing this section of the tool, a table like this will be included in the long-term stewardship plan for your site. So, additional known and potential stakeholders from Table 5 of the ITRC document will be included in an appendix of a plan. So, if you need to update this table later, you can refer to that appendix. So, this slide shows you how these tables are generated. Within the tool, the column headings are shown, and one blank row is provided. You click on a cell and select a response from a pull-down tab, or you type in a response. When you complete the row, click on the plus sign to add a new row. Continue filling information and adding rows until your table is complete. After all the required questions have been answered, tables have been generated, and figures have been uploaded to the tool, click on the Create Report button in the bottom right-hand corner of the last page, and a document called ITRC IC Final will be created in the folder with the templates. feel free to save this as another name in another folder. You can edit it as you would any other Word document. You can edit the text, format the headings, add or delete image files, spell check, update the table of contents, cut and paste, move things around, whatever you would do with a normal Word document. In the final document, the unanswered questions will be blanks. That question not answered text will be gone. There won't be highlighted text indicating answers to the questions in the form either. In addition to saving the Word file of the plan, you can also save the form answers and update them later. Or you can reset the form to use it for a new long-term stewardship plan for another site. Just make sure you have already saved your template. And if you want to keep that original form, make sure you save a copy of that to another folder elsewhere so it doesn't reset the whole template you just made when you save it. Click the table of contents button in the form to return to the beginning. So then you close the form and click the reset answers buttons to use it as a clean tool for a new project. So as promised, here's the link so you can download your tool and generate your own long-term stewardship plan. And here's Carol to summarize all the information that we discussed today.
Well, thank you, Lynn. So to wrap up, I'd like to circle back around to the diagram that you see on your screen, which is the IC life cycle that we've presented throughout the presentation and throughout the guidance document. The blue arrows across the top show the critical elements of the IC life cycle. And then beneath the life cycle, we listed the critical elements that should be considered to achieve a successful IC management program. And we believe that failure of any of the elements can result in failure of the IC. And as we've discussed, these elements essentially form the structure of the guidance document. And the guidance document also provides examples and recommendations for good stewardship practices, including the tool that Lynn just presented for developing a long-term stewardship plan. So as we wrap up, I'd like to ask you to think about the ICs where you are a stakeholder and ask yourself how the ICs are being managed at your sites to ensure long-term success. And to circle back around to our survey, when we asked the states in 2015, we found that over half of the states responding did not at the time have standard practices in place for managing ICs across their various programs. So if you don't currently have an IC, a formal IC management program, don't worry, you're not alone. But over the past 5 years, our understanding is that more and more people are getting on board with updating their IC management programs. We hope this training has provided valuable information to help you develop a long-term stewardship program for the ICs at your sites. But we also realize that you're going to have to go back to your organizations and convince key decision makers to spend the time and the money to put these programs into place. And we'd like to encourage you to use the guidance document to support your cause when you're having these discussions with the key decision makers in your organizations. And you can use the guidance document as a credible consensus-based tool to support these discussions. And remember, the ultimate goal of ICs is to prevent exposure to contamination that's been left in place. It's really that simple. If there's a failure of an IC, the risk of the exposure to contamination goes up. Ultimately, we hope this guidance document will help you avoid the situations like the ones in Michigan and Hawaii that we presented earlier. And we believe that these situations could have been avoided if the states had used the recommendations and suggestions presented in the document. In fact, in Hawaii, there was another emergency utility repair in the same area as the one described earlier. But the second time around, the utility company used frac tanks to collect the groundwater instead of discharging to the storm drain. So they did it right the second time around since they were aware of the impacted groundwater. So awareness is important. Now, to conclude our presentation, we'd like to encourage you to review the guidance document and try out the long-term stewardship plan. And we know we've covered a lot of information today. So if you'd like to go back and review the presentation, An archive of the training session is available through ITRC. And also, please feel free to contact any of the trainers if you have further questions. Our contact information was provided on the slide at the beginning of the PowerPoint presentation, which is available on the website. With that, we'd like to thank you for participating in the training today, and I'll turn it back over to the moderator for the Q&A session.
All right, thank you, Carol. And with that, we will go right into our last Q&A portion of the training today. If you guys have any questions and want our trainers to address them, please put them in the pod now so that we can get to that. And before we do that, to give you guys some time to enter those questions, I would just like to remind you that we do have a feedback form available for you all to let us know how the training went today. The link is here on the slide under the third bullet. So be sure to fill that out, especially if you would like a certificate of completion for today's training. So I'll wait a few minutes, and if there are any questions, we can address them. And if not, we can wrap up the training a little bit early. All right, doesn't look like we have any questions for our trainers. I did just put the link to the feedback form in the chat. It is also on the training page that brought you here, one of the last tabs called feedback form. So with that, we'll conclude our training for today. Thank you attendees for coming and joining us, and thank you trainers for being here today. If you need any further clarification on any questions, or you have any further questions, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. You are also welcome, like Carol said, to follow up with our trainers directly. You can find their emails in the PowerPoint, which is also posted on the training page that brought you here today. So with that, I hope everybody has a wonderful rest of their afternoon, and we will conclude today's training.